Hi, this is Chris, and this is Foundations for Social Innovation. And in this module, we're going to be exploring how to act in systems. We're going to be looking at alternative processes and practices for transforming systems. And we're going to be looking at the different kinds of action that you can take when you know what you want to change a system to. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future, and the elders on the lands on which you're listening. In previous episodes, we looked at thinking in systems and then how to model how systems change over time. Now, with some understanding of how systems work, we're going to talk about how you go about creating change in systems and the actions you can take to create that change. We're going to look at three different articulations of how to go about creating change in systems. We're going to start with David Stroh's four-step process. And this is something that I'd say is on the more technical side of systems change. It's a process designed with systems dynamics and a systems analysis at its core. We're also going to learn from the thinking of Tyson Yunkaporta and his reflections on how to work with Indigenous knowledge through complexity. Another four-step process as it happens, but one that he describes as being fractal. And then, on the more spiritual side of things, we're going to delve deep into Theory U as articulated by Otto Sharma, which is a process, but also a philosophy, a set of practices, and an approach to changing systems, which is firmly rooted in the belief that the only way the systems can change is by changing the inequalities of people, especially those participating in the systems change process. Whilst there are differences across these three approaches, there are also some similarities. First and foremost, they're all social processes. They're collaborative, multiple people are involved from across the system. And they do the work. They do the looking, the learning, the analysis, the talking, depending on what kind of process you're taking. And those processes are as much about transforming those people, their mindsets, or even their sense of self, as they are about changing a system that's external to the room. Most of the processes have an explicit focus on understanding the current state of affairs before articulating a future state of affairs and then thinking about, well, how can we actually get there? So whilst there is analysis of the current, there is also some dreaming, some creativity about what might be in the future. But if I was to differentiate them, and this oversimplifies things, I'd say that David Stroh's process is mostly a technical process that relies on an analysis of a particular system and the dynamics within it. Tyson Yunkaporta's process is, above everything else, a relational process and one that starts with mutual trust and respect and is propelled forward by yarning. Whereas Theory U, well, really, it's a process that is about transforming the inner self of the people involved in the systems change work. So in that sense, it's spiritual and it's really driven forward in part by intuition. In Theory U, Otto Sharma talks about three different kinds of complexity. The first is dynamic complexity, where cause and effect are distant in time and space. And this, I think, links to David Stroh's approach, which is anchored around an analysis of the dynamics within a particular system. The second is social complexity, where actors have different views and interests. And I think here we can learn something from Tyson Yonker Porter's approach with its focus on respect and on the relational. And the third kind of complexity that fits between these two, he calls it emerging complexity, where you're looking to create a disruptive pattern of innovation and change. This is where he thinks Theory U is best applied to help create breakthrough innovations that transform systems to something new and different. In the last episode, we heard David Stroh recount a story of creating change with homelessness providers in Michigan. They were a collaborative that had existed for 10 years without any real progress on the problem. They had an opportunity for some significant new funding. They reflected on their current situation and realized that because they provided temporary accommodation, they were in fact perpetuating homelessness. In the language of archetypes we explored in the last module, they had a quick fix that seemed to work. It seemed to work because it addressed the most visible aspect, people sleeping rough, whilst the main issue of people not having somewhere to live long-term remained unaddressed. Their action was to act as one and direct funding to the single provider amongst their collaboration that was the provider of long-term housing. In his book, Systems Thinking for Social Change, David Stroh lays out the four-step process for change that lay behind that example. And what you're going to hear now is an extract from the audiobook.
The four-stage change process. Chapter 5. An overview of the four-stage change process. In the summer of 2006, Michael Goodman and I supported a group of community leaders in Calhoun County, Michigan, population 100,000, to develop a 10-year plan to end homelessness. The agreement forged by government officials at the municipal, state, and federal levels, along with business leaders, service providers, and homeless people themselves, came after years of leadership inertia and conflict regarding what needed to be done to solve the problem. Moreover, the plan signaled a paradigmatic shift in how the community viewed the role of temporary shelters and other emergency response services. Rather than see them as part of the solution to homelessness, people came to view these programs as among the key obstacles to ending it. The plan won state funding, and a new organization led by an executive director and multi-sector board was formed to steer implementation. Service providers who had previously worked independently and competed for foundation and public monies came together to work in new ways, as exemplified by their unanimous decision to relocate HUD funding from one service provider's temporary housing program to a permanent supportive housing program run by another provider. Jennifer Bentley, who chaired the planning process, observed, "I learned the difference between changing a particular system and leading systemic change." In the plan's first 6 years of operation, from 2007 to 2012, Calhoun County did a remarkable job of securing permanent housing for the homeless, especially in the face of the economic downturn of 2008 to 2009. Homelessness decreased by 14%, from 1,658 to 1,419, despite a 34% increase in unemployment and a 7% increase in evictions. Why was this intervention so successful when many other collective attempts to improve the quality of people's lives fall short? The local foundations and other partners who were involved combined two significant interventions: a proactive community development effort that engaged leaders in the three major sectors, along with homeless people themselves, and a systems analysis that enabled all stakeholders to agree on a shared picture of why homelessness persisted and where the leverage lay in ending it. In other words, the approach merged more conventional processes that facilitate convening people systemically, such as bringing the whole system into the room, with tools that helped the stakeholders transcend their immediate self-interests by thinking systemically as well. Convening and thinking systemically. Part 2 of this book enables you to integrate these processes of convening and thinking systemically into a 4-stage change process. Michael and I developed the approach as a result of working with hundreds of executives and change agents who were responsible for leading systemic change and did not know how to use the power of systems thinking to increase their effectiveness. The approach also supports people interested in systems thinking to integrate it into the world of practical action and performance improvement. Leaders of social change recognize the power of convening multiple and diverse stakeholders, including those representing the nonprofit, public, and private sectors, to achieve breakthroughs around issues that affect all parties. The past 25 years have seen many innovations in large group interventions designed to increase communication across the sectors, such as Future Search, Open Space Technology, and the World Cafe. These interventions are often structured as individual events or a series of events. In addition, new processes such as Collective Impact, reviewed in Chapter 2, Theory U, Social Labs, and Collaboration Partnerships for Environmental Sustainability have also emerged. Michael and I have found that systems thinking can enhance many of these approaches by providing what Otto Scharmer, the creator of Theory U, calls a collective sensing mechanism that enables all stakeholders to see the bigger picture each of them is a part of. This mechanism also helps people appreciate how they not only support, but also often unwittingly undermine system performance, thereby empowering them to think and act more effectively. The 4-stage change process. We built our 4-stage change process on the creative tension model introduced by Peter Senge in the fifth discipline. This model proposes that the energy for change is mobilized by establishing a discrepancy between what people want and where they are. If people hold to the vision of what they want and are simultaneously clear and candid about where they are, then the tension will tend to resolve in favor of what they want. This principle applies both at the individual level and at the collective level. Translated to the collective level, when people have a common aspiration, as expressed by a shared vision, mission, and set of values, and a shared understanding of not only where they are now, but also why, then they establish a creative tension, which they are drawn to resolve in favor of their aspiration. Developing a shared understanding of why the current reality exists is essential to addressing the challenge that stakeholders often agree on where they are at the top of the iceberg, for instance, feeling pressure to build another shelter, but they fail to see the underlying system structure that affects and is affected by all of them, their dependence on temporary shelters as a solution to homelessness. Developing a shared picture of what people want, as well as of a reality at a deep level, enables stakeholders to experience their responsibility for the whole system instead of just their role. It produces a state of alignment where people freely commit. I'll get my part done, and I'll make sure we all get the whole thing done. For example, they might question a decision to invest in new shelters and promote additional investment in permanent, safe, affordable, and supportive housing instead. So we expanded the creative tension model into a 4-stage change process where stakeholders 1. Build a foundation for change and affirm their readiness for change. 2. Clarify current reality at all levels of respective responsibilities for creating it. 3. Make an explicit choice in favor of the aspiration they espouse. 4. Begin to bridge the gap by focusing on high-leverage interventions, engaging additional stakeholders, and learning from experience. Stage 1. 1 is to build a foundation for change. The intended result is to develop collective readiness for change. Stage 1 incorporates 3 steps. Engage key stakeholders. This involves identifying the range of possible stakeholders and designing strategies to engage them individually and collectively. Establish common ground by creating initial pictures of what people want to achieve and where they are now. It is useful at this point to develop an initial shared vision of the ideal outcomes and an overview of what is and is not working now. Build people's capacities to collaborate with each other. This involves developing people's abilities to think systemically and hold productive conversations around difficult issues, as well as their underlying capacity to take responsibility for current reality. For example, the Calhoun County Project brought together leaders from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, along with homeless people themselves, to develop their 10-year plan to end homelessness. They engaged in shared visioning and were introduced to productive conversation and systems thinking tools early on in the process. Stage 2. Face current reality. The intended results are to build not only a shared understanding of what is happening and why, but also acceptance of people's responsibilities, however unwitting, for creating this reality. While it might seem logical at this point to develop a clearer and richer picture of the ideal future, Michael and I have found that digging more deeply into reality at this stage more accurately reflects many people's desires to understand and be understood for where they are before venturing too far forward. As Otto Scharmer observed, based on his work with Ed Schein, Professor Emeritus of Management at MIT, the primary job of leadership is to enhance the individual and systemic capacity to see, to deeply attend to the reality that people face and enact. The tasks of Stage 2 are to identify people to interview about the history of the current situation and clarify what questions to ask, organize and begin to improve the quality of the information, develop a preliminary systems analysis of how different factors interact over time to support or undermine achievement of the vision. Engage people in developing their own analysis as much as possible. Surface the mental models that influence how people behave. Create catalytic conversations that stimulate awareness, acceptance, and alternatives. For example, Michael and I interviewed 50 leaders from across the three sectors, as well as homeless people, developed an initial systems map that we initially vetted with a small design committee, and refined and then shared our analysis with a wider steering committee. Stage 3. Purpose of Stage 3 is to help people make an explicit choice in favor of what they really want. The intended result is that they consciously commit to their highest aspirations with full awareness of the costs, not just the benefits, of realizing them. The steps to achieve this result are to help stakeholders identify the case for the status quo uncovered in Stage 2, the short-term benefits of the current system, such as quick fixes that work, for instance, and the immediate gratification that comes from implementing them, and the costs of changing, such as the need to make longer-term investments in effort, time, and money. Compare this with the case for change described in Stage 1, the benefits of change and the costs of not changing. Create both and solutions that achieve the benefits of both, or be willing to make hard trade-offs between them. Make an explicit choice and bring it to life through a vision that illuminates what people feel called to or deeply wish to create. A critical turning point in Calhoun County's 10-year planning effort occurred when the stakeholders realized that their current system was perfectly designed to help people cope with homelessness. However, the way they were operating actually undermined their avowed purpose to end homelessness. Stage 4. To help people bridge the gap between what they deeply care about, which they affirm in Stage 3, and where they are now, as clarified in Stage 2. This final stage involves identifying leverage points and establishing a process for continuous learning and expanded engagement. Specific tasks are to 1. Propose and refine high-leverage interventions with community input. This includes A. Increasing people's awareness of how the system functions now. B. Rewiring causal feedback relationships. C. Shifting mental models. D. Reinforcing the chosen purpose through updated goals and plans, metrics, incentives, authority structures, and funding. 2. Establish a process for continuous learning and outreach. This covers A. Engaging existing stakeholders on an ongoing basis. B. Developing an implementation plan that incorporates demonstration projects as part of a long-term roadmap. C. Refining the data to be gathered based on new goals and metrics. D. Evaluating and revising the plan regularly with input from current stakeholders. E. expanding stakeholder involvement by tapping additional resources and scaling up that works. In the case of Calhoun County, the leverage points people identified became the goals of their 10-year plan, and others have become involved in the implementation. Broader involvement to end homelessness includes engaging stakeholders responsible for economic development, affordable housing, foster care, and the criminal justice system. While the four stages and supporting tasks are listed numerically, the process itself is not always linear, as we'll see in the chapters ahead, which map out the tasks associated with each step. The lessons from stage four, for instance, feed back into a new stage one in an ongoing circular process. Allowing ample time for the process is critical. In this case, the shortest distance between two points is indeed a circle.
At the end of the book, Sand Talk, Tyson Yunker Porter reflects on 2 years of learning from elders across the continent and what he and his co-travellers learned about Indigenous knowledge and how to act with it in a respectful and meaningful way. The four-step process is another way to think about working in complexity, one grounded in Indigenous ways of valuing, being, and knowing. And this is Tyson reading his own book.
So now I will share with you a cultural process for enacting these ways and protocols, if you wish. I will leave it up to you to figure out how you want to store these ideas on your last row of knuckles. This process for working with Indigenous knowledge in sustainable ways came from 2 years of following songlines from north to south, then east coast to west coast with Mama Doris Shillingsworth. We wanted to find a pattern that was common to all different groups, a process that could be used by anyone to come to Indigenous knowledge productively and without doing damage. We had hundreds of yarns, and Mama Doris fairly talked my ear off in the car, so much that once I nearly crashed trying to take it all in. She worked with her knowledge of Mundugara, which is the Murawari word for the creation snake. Linking up that songline all the way to Wagal, rainbow serpent story of the Noongar in Perth. Every yarn on the way was first grounded in the protocol of respect, which every elder insisted on, so that became our touchstone. We had four questions. What can we know? What do we know? How do we know it? How do we work with that? The answers we found were as follows. What we can know is determined by our obligations and relationships to people, ancestors, land, law, and creation. What we know is that the role of custodial species is to sustain creation, which is formed from complexity and connectedness. The way we know this is through our cultural metaphors. The way we work with this knowledge is by positioning, sharing, and adapting our cultural metaphors. What we had found was a broad, common description of Indigenous ways of valuing, ways of being, ways of knowing, and ways of doing. These things had a widespread order, a sequence in all cultural activities in which people were sharing or producing knowledge on country. We had our own personal metaphors for describing this process of induction. I referred to it as spirit, heart, head, and hands. Mama Doris knew it as respect, connect, reflect, direct. She insisted on that order. She also noted that non-Aboriginal people seemed to work through the same steps, but in reverse. Mama Doris has observed interventions and programs imposed on her community for over half a century, noticing that they always begin with the last step, direct. Government agents come into the community with a plan for change, and they direct activities toward this change immediately. When it all fails, they go backward to the next step, reflect. They gather data and measure outcomes and try to figure out what went wrong. Then they realize they didn't form relationships with the community, so belatedly they go to the next step, connect. Through these relationships, they discover the final step, which should have been the first, finding a profound respect for members of the community they ruined. They cry as they say farewell and return to the city, calling, "Thank you, I've learned so much from you." Invert that process, and you'll have something approximating an appropriate way of coming to Indigenous knowledge and working towards sustainable solutions. The first step of respect is aligned with values and protocols of introduction, setting rules and boundaries. This is the work of your spirit, your gut. The second step, connect, is about establishing strong relationships and routines of exchange that are equal for all involved. Your way of being is your way of relating, because all things only exist in relationship to other things. This is the work of your heart. The third step, reflect, is about thinking as part of the group and collectively establishing a shared body of knowledge to inform what you will do. This is the work of the head. The final step, direct, is about acting on that shared knowledge in ways that are negotiated by all. This is the work of the hands. Respect, connect, reflect, direct. In that order. Everything in creation is sentient and carries knowledge. Therefore, everything is deserving of our respect. Even narcissists. Echidna is the villain in Turtle Story. So in the end, Turtle eats him. Today, you'll find in the skeletons of freshwater turtles a big spiky ball of bones that serves no evolutionary or biological purpose. And that's echidna in there still. It's a living reminder in the pattern of creation of those ancestral spirits who made the Big Bang. And also a living warning to all narcissists who like to think they are greater than. But echidna is only the villain during the events of the story. After he is punished, he doesn't hold on to that guilt, and others don't hold that blame for him. They let it go, and he lets it go, learns from his mistakes, and becomes something wonderful, the species with the largest brain in the world in relation to his body size. Echidna is often somebody who does terrible things in our stories. Why else would he end up with so many spears thrown into him? Turtle does not hate him, because without that struggle, the universe wouldn't even be here. Echidna doesn't hate himself either, for the same reason. Guilt is like any other energy. You can't accumulate it or keep it because it makes you sick and disrupts the system you live in. You have to let it go, face the truth, make amends, and let it go. My hope is that one day everybody can find a place under the law of the land where they live, transitioning our living systems into something that is sustainable in the true sense of the word. Omanjuma calls it the seven families coming home and uniting again. We'd like everybody to look up at the stars and see the same stories there once more, and stop asking the question, "Are we alone?" Of course we're not. Everything in the universe is alive and full of knowledge. Now that the small questions of existence have been answered, why are we here? How should we live? What will happen when we die? Us too should be able to get back to the business of asking some of the bigger questions. We'll need living lands and bodies to do that, though. So let's put these hands of ours to work.
The third approach we're going to explore is Theory U. And I wanted to start with a case study of Theory U in action. In 2002, a number of leading systems thinkers and leaders of change in the food system came together. Together, they identified the potential of innovative cross-sectoral collaboration to initiate change in the global food system. Over the next several years, the Sustainable Food Lab evolved from an idea to an ongoing program involving a wide variety of influential international stakeholders and leaders from across the food system. The initial lab team was made up of leaders from major corporations, producer groups, community organizations, and international NGOs. These members undertook a series of learning journeys, retreats, and innovation workshops as part of the Change Lab. The lab involved action learning and activities that transcended and cross-cut traditional barriers between parties who did not normally collaborate. It provided space to explore potential for creative problem solving, to shift sustainability from niche to the mainstream. Out of this process, innovative pilot projects were designed to leverage the resources and expertise of the diverse team members. These projects were launched with the intent to impact crucial nodes in the value chain of the global food system, focusing on issues such as farmers' livelihoods and ethical sourcing policies. So this is the story of the Sustainable Food Lab, and it was I'm reading here from a case study created by Rios Partners, who facilitated the lab, and WWF, World Wildlife Fund, who were part of the lab. I wanted to feature this story because it's been named by Peter Senge and also by Otto Sharma as one of the biggest and most impressive systems change initiatives that they'd seen. And so it starts off with this really careful initiating process with the two main figures who were leading this process in 2002 start meeting a number of different potential members of this systems change group, of the Change Lab. They want to find 35 of them, and they really search for people who are committed to moving towards sustainable ways of working, even if they're not doing that yet. And they also look for a cross-section of people across the world, but across different size producers, international NGOs, local farmers. So they've got a real diversity of people coming together. And they bring the people together first in 2004. And this is around a learning journey. So they've worked with the group to work out what it is they want to learn, what are their questions that haven't yet been answered. And then what they call the secretariat, the sort of facilitators, organize a whole set of learning journeys for the people together in Brazil in small groups. And they go and they meet providers and farmers. And for some of the big players, it's the first time they've really been on the ground and seen what's happened. And presumably for some of the smaller providers, it's the first time they've connected with some of the big players. So that happens in 2004. And then after that, they bring together the group to construct a shared map of the current reality of the system based on all of those varied experiences. And they identify more opportunities for learning. So that happens in the Netherlands in 2004. And then a couple of months later, they take them all to Arizona and the desert in Arizona, and they hike them out to a set of tents that have been pitched out in the outback there, and tell them not to talk to each other and not to go more than 50 meters from the tents themselves. And then they leave them there for 2 days to be in silence and contemplate on what they've learned so far. So this is a core feature of the Theory U process, and I think it gives you a bit of an insight into how it's different from many of the others. It starts with co-initiating. The second movement is about co-sensing, and then what they call co-presencing, which is really about creating a space for intuition, for answers to arise from within you. And it's based on trying to understand what are the sets of conditions that have allowed creative individuals and breakthrough innovations to emerge. And this sort of communing with nature, this space of silence has come out to them as a critical point. So after Arizona in 2005, they then start moving into the co-creation space. They start realizing designs for actions within the system. And it's from that they start then to launch a number of ventures. So the Framing Initiative, which aims to reset the way people think and talk about agriculture. The Business Coalition of US-based Companies Initiatives, the Fisheries Initiative, which aims to deliver economic benefits to fish harvesters, the Latin American Family Farm Initiative, the Responsible Commodities Initiative, the Food for Health and Learning Initiative. And this goes on and these meetings keep happening and this case study goes up until 2008 through different levels of organization as they start to create this portfolio or cascade of different initiatives to shift broadly towards more sustainable systems of agriculture. So there's a very detailed case study if you want to read more. But what's important here, I wanted to give you a very concrete basis to understand the U process, because it does get quite abstract. There's some quite heady language you're about to hear in how it's described. But the Sustainable Food Initiative started, the key diagram in the U process is a U, and the Sustainable Food Lab started at the top of the U with co-initiating, then moved down the left-hand side of the U to co-sensing, understanding the current situation. Then there was that time in the desert, and that's at the bottom of the U, the co-presencing space, the space between the current and the future. And then they moved up the right-hand side of the U into that co-creation space where they were starting to prototype and starting to build parts of the future system, a microcosm of the future system. So this is chapter 21 from Leading from the Future as It Emerges, Theory U by Otto Sharma. And this chapter is all about the principles and practices of presencing for profound innovation and change. And it provides a bit of an overview of the Theory U approach. So I'm going to read from it here. To lead profound change is to shift the inner place from which a system operates. This can be done only collaboratively, using what I have called a social technology, throughout this book. Having discussed individual aspects of this social technology, we now turn to looking at it as a whole and from a practitioner's point of view. What are the principles and practices that constitute that technology? The tools that would help me and others to link with and realize our best future possibility? The social technology of presencing is based on five major movements. Each movement is grounded in the principles and practices discussed below. They are this: co-initiating, listening to others and to what life calls you to do. Co-sensing, go to the places of most potential and listen with your mind and heart wide open. Co-presencing, retreat and reflect, allow the inner knowledge to emerge. Co-creating, prototype a microcosm of the new in order to explore the future by doing. And co-evolving, grow innovation ecosystems by seeing and acting from the emerging whole. Co-initiating, listen to others and to what life calls you to do. The first movement, co-initiating, focuses on beginning from nothing and uncovering some common ground. We start by creating a field or container from which the remaining four movements can come into being. How? By listening. By listening to other core players in the field. By listening to what life calls you to do. And by listening to what emerges from a forward-orientated constellation of core players in the larger system. And within each of these five movements, Sharma then gives us some core practices. There are 24 of them, and I'll talk to a few of them here. So within co-initiating, the first is to attend, to listen to what life calls you to do. All great ideas are triggered by something. The essence of the you process is to strengthen our presence and activate participation in the world. Second practice, connect. Listen to and dialogue with interesting players in the field. The second domain of listening takes you out of your normal world and to the interesting edges and corners of the field that you are drawn to. Talk to some of the most interesting players and listen to them in order to learn what it would take to move the current situation towards its best future possibility. Talk to both the highly visible core players and to the less visible ones. The people without a voice who may be shut down or shut out by the dysfunctionality of the current system. The most important players, helpers, future partners and guides often turn out to be different from what you expect. Therefore, your inner work is to stay open to suggestions and to stay tuned to the help and guidance that the universe offers you. The third practice. Co-initiate a diverse core group that inspires a common intention. The essence of co-initiating is to convene a constellation of players that need one another to take action and to move forward. You need the right folks at the right time in the right place. The opposite of co-initiation is marketing, getting people to buy into your idea. That almost never works because it's just your idea. So part of the art of convening these players is to loosen your own grip on the idea without necessarily giving up. You lead by painting a picture that is intentionally incomplete. You make a few strokes and you leave a lot of blank space that others can add to and feel as if they've made a contribution. In this way, you shift the power dynamics from ownership to belonging. So you can hear in this writing that the you process differentiates itself from a lot of the other systems change processes by a real focus on the inner self, your inner qualities, and how you show up and how people in the group show up in order to create the espoused systems change. Let's move on to the second movement, co-sensing. Go to the places of most potential and listen with your mind and heart wide open. Having initiated a common future intention with the core group, the next challenge is to bring that intention to its feet by forming a prototyping action team that goes on a journey of sensing, discovering, and learning by doing. This is the fourth practice. Form a highly committed prototyping core team and clarify essential questions. It's important for the prototyping core team to reflect on the diversity of players and stakeholders mentioned above and to commit itself to making the prototype projects the number one priority over a certain period of time. For example, 4, 6, or 9 months. Practice 5. Take deep dive journeys to the places of most potential. Deep dive learning journeys connect people to the contexts and ideas that are relevant to creating the possible future. The deep dive journey moves one's operating perspective from inside a familiar world, the institutional bubble, to an unfamiliar world, outside, that is surprising, fresh, and new. So you remember in the sustainable food case study how the deep dive journeys were described as learning journeys where the team spent time in Brazil looking at food systems from a number of different perspectives. Back to the book. Deep dive journeys are usually best when conducted one-on-one or in small groups of up to about 5 people so the team can fit into one car. It works through the practices of shadowing, dialogue conversations, and if possible, in ongoing activities. The preparation and debriefing are done in a disciplined, structured, and timely fashion. Practice 6. Observe, observe, observe. Suspend your voice of judgment and connect with your sense of wonder. Without the capacity to suspend your voice of judgment, all efforts to get inside the place of most potential will be in vain. Suspending your voice of judgment means shutting down or embracing and changing the habit of judging based on the experiences and patterns of the past in order to open up a new space of exploration, inquiry, and wonder. Practice 7. Practice deep listening and dialogue. Connect to others with your mind, heart, and will wide open. When connecting to other people and to contexts, activate and open up all 4 channels of listening. Listen from what you know, from what surprises you, from empathizing with the interviewee, and from what wants to emerge. Practice 8. Create collective sensing organs that allow the system to see itself. Maybe the biggest institutional gap in seeking profound systems innovation is today's lack of collective sensing mechanisms. We have a lot of collective downloading mechanisms. By contrast, collective sensing mechanisms use the power of shared seeing and dialogue to trap an unused resource of collected sense-making and thinking together. And now we move on to the third movement. So the core diagram at the heart of Theory U is a U, and we've just been coming down the left-hand side of the U, and co-presencing is what sits at the bottom of the U, and you might want to look at the diagram in the slides if you haven't already. So the third movement, co-presencing, retreat and reflect, allow the inner knowing to emerge. And co-presencing is what the sustainable food system team were doing when they were put into the Arizona desert for 2 days and told not to talk to each other. Co-presencing, retreat and reflect, allow the inner knowing to emerge. After deeply immersing yourself in the contexts and places of most potential, the next movement focuses on accessing a deeper source of knowing, connecting to the future that wants to emerge through you, co-presencing. Practice 9, letting go. Letting go of your old self and the stuff that must die. The biggest obstacle to moving through the you comes from within. It emerges from your resistance, individually and collectively. Dealing with resistance is essential when you move down the left-hand side of the you. Don't be surprised when your resistance shows up again and again. It happens to everyone. But as you become a pro, you know in advance that it will pop up at certain stages and that your job is to be prepared to meet and deal with it through calmness, appreciation, and focus. Moving down the U invites you to suspend your voice of judgment, reverse your cynical view of the situation, and overcome your fear of letting go of your old self. Practice 10, letting come. Connect and surrender to the future that wants to emerge through you. The most important leadership tool is the leader's self, yourself. At the foundation of this principle and at the foundation of the whole presencing approach lies this simple assumption. Every human being is not one, but two. One is the person who we have become through the journey of the past. The other one is the dormant being of the future we could become through our own forward journey. Who we become will depend on the choices we make and the actions we take now. That future being is our highest and best future possibility. The essence of presencing is to get these two selves, these two beings, to talk and to listen to each other. Practice 11, intentional silence. Pick a practice that helps you to connect with your source. The currency that counts at the bottom of the U is not ideas, words, or insights. Here you must use a different currency, practice. Practice is what we do every day. Thus, this principle is about picking a personal practice that will help you connect to your future resonance. Practice 12, follow your journey. Do what you love, love what you do. For many people, the gateway to accessing the deeper sources of knowing involves a deep dive into the essence of their work. Michael Ray of Stanford University frames this principle as do what you love, love what you do. His motto captures what I've heard many successful creators and innovators say. In order to access your best creative potential, you have to go on a journey. A journey in which you follow your bliss, your feeling, your felt sense of the emerging future. You trust that sense more than all the good advice you get from other people, which may also be valuable. But at the end of the day, the essence of your creativity is about accessing a deeper source that is unique to you, your life, your future. The road to accessing one's creativity includes the stages of nothing much happening, boredom, and then noticing and responding to an inner impulse that evolves within yourself. It's difficult to learn how to do these things when you are managed by a tight system of exterior activities, rewards, and control. I think what we've heard so far about the movements and the principles and the practices of Theory U will give you a good flavor for the kind of approach that it is. So far, we've moved down the left-hand side of the U, we're at the bottom, and we're about to move up the right-hand side of the U. And I'll just give you a flavour here of the remaining two movements. co-creating. Prototype the new order to explore the future by doing. The movement of co-creating focuses on putting ideas onto their feet by prototyping microcosms of the future that you want to create, and by fast cycle learning that constantly iterates the existing prototype based on feedback from all key stakeholders. An interesting detail during this stage is that the sequence in which the new shows up in the human mind is contrary to conventional wisdom, as follows. 1. It usually begins with an unspecified emotion or feeling. 2. That feeling morphs into a sense of the what, the new insight or idea. 3. Then the what is related to a context, problem or challenge where it could produce a breakthrough innovation. The where, the context. 4. Only then do you begin to develop a form in which the what and the where are framed by a rational structure and form of presentation. This sequence can be traced in almost any type of breakthrough innovation. The biggest mistake when dealing with innovation is to put the cart before the horse by first focusing on the rational mind in order for a new insight to emerge. The other condition must already exist. In short, connecting to one's best future possibility and creating powerful breakthrough ideas requires learning to access the intelligence of the heart and the hand, not only the intelligence of the head. The rational mind is usually the last participant on the scene. And this is another point of difference, I think, for Theory U, is this focus of what comes from within, the inner hunch, your intuition, feeling. It sounds pretty wacky, but for me, it certainly lines up to much more creative work that I've done, where it doesn't, it comes as a feeling rather than something. The fifth and final movement is co-evolving. Growing innovation ecosystems by seeing and acting from the emerging whole. Once the prototypes are reviewed and assessed by the various key stakeholders, the next movement focuses on piloting and evolving the new in the right kind of institutional ecosystem and supporting infrastructure. The U process can be applied to practical situations in three different ways. As a process, as a set of field principles, and by operating from the presence of source. First, as a process. You follow the sequence of initiating, sensing, presencing, prototyping, institutionalizing. That's a beginning. But for the process to work, you need to connect to the two deeper levels, principles and source. Otherwise, it is just another mechanical tool that some people use to put other people in straitjackets and charge money for it. Second, as a set of principles and practices, you apply all 24 principles to the situation at hand. You situate and adapt the process as needed in a context. And third, as connecting to and operating from the presence of your deepest source, that is, from the bottom of the you. At this level, even the scaffolding of the principles falls away. The connection to this source level is articulated in the following three root principles: intentional grounding, relational grounding, and authentic grounding. They establish a foundation for the presence of a social field, an intentional grounding that serves the whole, a relational grounding that connects to the collective body of the social field, and an authentic grounding that connects you to your essential self as a vehicle for the emerging future. I want to finish off this exploration of acting in systems with two themes related to what you do when you've been through a systems process. How do you work out what action you can take? What are your options for doing that? And the first of those relates to power. In the middle of all of those systems processes is a point where you decide how to act in systems. What to do, even if it's only a prototype. The opportunities may be arrived at through a more analytic reflection on the dynamics within a system, or it may come through yarning, or it may come to you on a nature solo in the Arizona desert. But what are your options? Well, that depends. You may well, through your process, be able to identify some high leverage options. We've talked about leverage points before, the things under the water in the iceberg. And the deeper you go, the higher leverage the change. So things like mindsets being higher, being able to shift mindsets being a higher leverage intervention than policies or resource flows, for example. But in most cases, you can't go about changing mindsets or relationships or policies or resource flows directly because the people around the table don't have the power to do that. For example, you might want to change government policy and behavior around climate change, but you're still in school. So choices of how to act in systems are heavily governed by the power and influence of the people around the table. There are many different ways stakeholders at a table may choose to act in relation to high leverage actions, especially when reaching for levers that are beyond their immediate control. In some cases, the people around the table may already have the power to make high-level actions in the system. They can work with their own power, the way that the Coalition of Homeless Service Providers in Michigan got together to lobby the government to direct funding towards one provider. The people around the table may decide to convince those in power to make specific changes through persuasion, for example, through the use of evidence, the way climate science has tried to work, or through a different kind of persuasion, the way that children took the Minister of the Environment to court to find that she had a duty of care towards their future selves. The people around the table may try to force those in power to make specific changes through forceful disruption, for example, protests or building popularity, such as the Black Lives Matter movement. Or they may choose to shift the power dynamics in a system, empowering those with low power with resources or capabilities, the way that Our Town gives resources and capabilities to rural towns in order to support them to self-determine their local mental well-being and shift broader systems. While some actions are higher leverage than others, a change in a system can be anything. Starting with a systems perspective requires social innovators to open their minds to our diversity of actions. When we think of innovation, we often think of tangible things, new services, for example. But many of the things that create change in systems, many of the high leverage actions, are backstage or invisible. Laws, policy, relationships, resource flows, contracts, the things that sit beyond the traditional comfort zone of innovators. In the 2017 article for Stanford Social Innovation Review, Julia Batilana and Marissa Kimsey, based on research of hundreds of initiatives, identified three ways to create social change: agitation, orchestration, and innovation. And I find this a reliable catch-all framework to think about actions in systems and what balance of agitation, orchestration, and innovation a particular action might take. This is from their Stanford Social Innovation Review article. We identified three distinct roles played by those who participate in movements for social change: agitator, innovator, and orchestrator. An agitator brings the grievances of specific individuals or groups to the forefront of public awareness. An innovator creates an actionable solution to address these grievances. And an orchestrator coordinates actions across groups, organizations, and sectors to scale the proposed solution. Any pathway to social change requires all three. Agitation without innovation means complaints without ways forward. And innovation without orchestration means ideas without impact. In reality, the boundaries between these roles may blur, with some individuals and organizations playing multiple roles, either at once or sequentially. Far from being linear, the social change process may require that changemakers switch back and forth amongst these three roles. So using this framework, we can start to think about different kinds of systems actions based on their combination of agitation, innovation, and orchestration. Combine orchestration and agitation, and you get something like movements for change in systems. The Black Lives Matter movement, for example, or the school climate change movement. Combine orchestration and innovation, and you get something like platforms for innovation. Things like the Transition Towns movement that's spreading regenerative practices across communities in the world. Or veganism, which is spreading an innovation at a more personal level and in a more distributed way. Or something like the Teach Like a Champion movement that's spreading effective teaching practices starting in US schools. Combine innovation and agitation, and you have demonstration projects, things that are showing a different way of living is possible that also advocate for that change. An example I like here is Seacom, a sustainable town built outside of Cairo that shows a different way of living is possible that's gone on to influence Egyptian policy. And then you have complex projects that are a combination of agitation, innovation, and orchestration. They sit in the middle of all three. Things like Our Town, that's simultaneously orchestrating a movement of towns, innovating on the ground, and also agitating for change at a broader systems level. So far in our little systems mini-series, we've explored thinking in systems. We explored modelling systems and how they change over time. And in this episode, we've been looking at acting in systems and how to act in systems from the point of view of an individual, as a collective, but also how to act with particular innovations that aim to create broader changes and ripples through a system. And in the next session, we're going to be looking at telling the stories of systems and systems change work and how to communicate and bring along people on what can be quite a complex journey.